Okay, Mavis. Well, first of all, thank you so much. Just sincerely for being willing to come in and have this conversation with us. And it's kind of, a step in some, another step in some really lovely conversations that we've already had. And from the bottom of my heart, I want to thank you for reaching out to me. Just so you know, Mavis reached out to me directly and said, hey, kind of who are you and what are you doing? And what are you doing at UVic right after all the news came out? And we've just had some really lovely conversations since that point. So I feel very fortunate. So with that, would you mind introducing yourself, Mavis, however you wish?
My name is Mavis Underwood. My traditional name is Thiwanamot. That comes to me from my mother's side. Her grandmother in Nanaimo was Thiwanamot, gave the name to my mother, and my mother let me use that name. And it's now carried by my daughter and my granddaughter and another grandniece. So it's an important name. It grounds where our family is from. It grounds a lot of the feminine side of our family, the female side, where we originate from. So it's a very great honor for me to carry that name.
Where are you from, Mavis?
I'm from Sayout First Nation on the Saanich Peninsula. We're part of the Saanich Nation, and I've grown up there and lived there all my life.
Can you describe for me a little bit about what Sayout looks like?
Sayout is a very important place for me. Growing up right by the salt water and the fresh water to Tayot Creek, it's a very historical place as well. The Saanichton Bay Marina case, 1988, was decided there. And it was really a really important period of time to have such advocacy and support from church organizations that were all joined together as part of social justice. So they got behind Sayout First Nation and others to occupy a winter camp there to protest the Saanichton Bay Marina construction. And so that's right where I live. And now Sayout First Nation has a court case with James Island, Leltos. We are trying to reclaim our traditional island back because we believe it should have been protected under the Douglas Treaty. And so it's very important for us to bring forward a lot of the history of how land has been taken away or taken up by settlement or homesteading or expropriation. So we wanted to really bring it forward that land and that island had continued to be in use right up until 1970. We never really felt that we had lost it. And we would just really love to have that place back. It's a important geographical landmark. It's a sand dune geographical system that is actually quite fragile, and we would like to really have it as a place for traditional use.
And I think for those that might be listening to this, I mean, to paint a bit of an image in their mind when we think about a place like James Island, I mean, the channel is very narrow there. I mean, it's almost a stone's throw across from Sayout.
It's a beautiful spot. It has a lot of beaches there. It also has a lot of history of our ancestral remains, artifact remains. And that's the concern for us, is that there's not enough heed paid to the extent of the civilization of our people, the hundreds and thousands that occupied the coastline, particularly even of the Saanich Peninsula. So it's important for us to be able to assert our way of life, to integrate that history, that recognition into, if you want to call it Canadian history, local history, settlement history. We really need to have that recognition and understanding that we were self-sufficient, very independent people. We had a way of life that was very important to us and still is important to us. And we would really like to begin to educate and pass that along to children.
I think that's a really critical point here, Mavis, is I even think about, you know, my own youth, I suppose, after my family moved over from Greater Vancouver. I mean, we ended up living in or around the Cordova Bay area. And I spent lots of time on that beach as a child. But I know you see that beach quite differently than maybe a lot of settler people might, hey?
The Cordova Bay Beach is a site of significant ancestral remains, architecture, at least three big house sites were there, and those were for the extended families. And there's also the remains of what you would call a fish wall or a fish trap. So it would kind of like herd fish into a channel. And there's also a lot of shellfish were harvested there. But what happened with settlement, there just became so much sewer runoff, outfall, that people stopped going there. And then, of course, there was also so much settlement that people really felt not welcome there. But I believe Mr. McMorrin talked to some of the Sayout, and he had said he had always hoped we would come back, because he talked to some of the very old elders of Sayout, the Pelkey family, who were camping there overnight to harvest clams, and they would chuck their clams on the beach and then bring it all home. And he said, I would really love if you people would be back here. And so, you know, with that, you know, we just kind of want that recognition. We may never receive compensation or what we really want, some land compensation back, because we're really land poor. We would like that recognition, that history, to be fully understood and respected. Again, because we were independent, we were free people, and we didn't live in a dependent way like many people are living now.
This makes me think of an experience that I've reflected on a lot, even as I walk on and off of that beach. And to me, the fundamental injustice, or the ignorance, I suppose, of our settler society is plainly obvious, where, you know, you come down onto the beach and there's a sign that says no shellfish harvesting, you know, PSP poisoning, so on and so forth. And it's along all those beaches there. And I mean, one, it's such a disservice to those animals themselves, you know. But two, that represents really the destruction of an entire way of living right off that land right there. I mean, that was the grocery store for so long. And I always wonder when I pass by that sign, whether or not people even see that or not, and whether or not they even put the connection together in the mind, what that really is representing, and what essentially a loss even that represents.
It's actually representing infringement on a protected Aboriginal right. And it's an act of extinguishment to allow it to continue without some kind of intervention. And that's what we're also trying to get government to understand, whether we're talking to municipal government or provincial government, regional water protectors. We're trying to get them to understand that untreated sewage, just for example, going into the waterway, is a hostile act. It's an act of fettering a protected right and harming the way of life of people that are to now be protected under UNDRIP. That and even under the Royal Proclamation, it was to be protected. We were to be left alone. And so that's what frustrates me, is the privilege that you see being played out, that you have no freedom, but there's a privilege there on the shoreline of Cordova Bay when you see the homes that are there, and that disdain that they have when we go and we talk about our remains there, human remains there, and we see and witness the stories that have been in the newspaper about the human remains there. It's turned into a melodrama. It's turned into like a crime drama. But really, it's about our existence as people, as relatively peaceful people. And so I guess that's my sort of desire to continue to speak about that is to really make sure that people understand, you know, the freedom we had, the independence we had, the way of life we had. It was a very treasured thing. It's very sacred, the relationship that we have with the environment, the gifts that have been provided by the environment. And you now hear young legal scholars like Robert Clifford talk about that with the at the National Energy Board. He had the oratory of Osgood Law behind him, but his voice also reflected the teachings that he had from his great-grandmother. And that was really important and precious to me to witness that, because that's what we want to see in our young people, is that standing up with that kind of power and embracing the best of what you would say best of both worlds, taking law, the institution of law, and turning it and making it integrate the teachings of Indigenous people and saying, this is justice, having these two and having you understand it, having that parallel. And that because now we see it, everybody is trying to protect the environment, trying to deal with climate and the changes that are occurring. And Indigenous people are saying, you know, you need to be a bit more reflective. You need to be more contemplative. You need to be more prayerful, because in some cases, it's not your show to run. And so it is important, though, to begin to replant and to take care, to put some oxygen back in. And so I was really proud that Sayout has really struggled to resist, you know, a lot of treaty negotiation processes and other ways to get ahead. But Sayout enacted a partnership with Cascadia Seaweed as an economic development project. And the beginning of that was to try to heal, maybe contribute to the healing of the saltwater, and to look at this idea of carbon, blue carbon, and what it can do to help heal. And of course, we know that seaweed is a very healing product. And we also know that even the fish use it. They go through it as a healing for them. So we thought, well, this might work. And if there's a bit of an economy there, if it's an education, a learning that we have, so much the better. And I think it's been exciting because our young people are interested in it. We've witnessed it around British Columbia that other young people are being employed in learning about seaweed and growing seaweed. And for us, it's just a very empowering situation to be involved in. And there are people who criticize and say, well, would you have done that before? Well, many of our people harvested and gathered seaweed just by hand. They didn't have the technology, but now there's technology. They'll evolve and absorb the technology, but it's the learning that they want to do and their survival and that sense of freedom and achievement that you get by learning and doing. I think that's very exciting for Sayout. And as part of that, and part of the Sanichton Bay Marina case, they've also enacted their own marine law to protect the bay. And that is like a follow through on the protection that was put over that bay because of the Sanichton Bay Marina case.
So already, Mavis, we've talked about a lot of really important issues here. We've talked about Indigenous law. We've talked about colonial violence. We've talked about inherent rights. We've talked about sovereignty. We've talked about maintenance of relationships with the past and the present and the future. We've talked about the importance of youth. We've talked about specific places. When you think about an opportunity like this that we've got with a podcast like this to talk to people even around the world, What are some of the things that you think we have to be talking about that we can't not talk about anymore in society? What are the things that you think, you know, we need to ensure that we're well grounded in as we have these conversations, so that we, you know, kind of arrest some of this violence that's still so present?
I think it's very important to really consider the impact of displacement off the land, off the traditional land, when you don't actually have a place to grow. That's a really big concern for me, because if you witness the population of Indigenous First Nations communities, we have a bulging population, youthful population under the age of 30, looking for a place, looking for a place for a home, a place of sense of family and community. And they're in most of the what's been created under the Indian Act as reserves, very land poor. And we really need to find a way to build the future for the young people, or they leave us, and they leave us in many different ways. They leave us for education, they leave us for employment, or they leave us because their mental health is poor and they've given up, that they don't have a place. And they need to have a place, and they need to have a belonging. I believe that's very important. I believe that we really need to work on the impact of the Indian Act on relationships with ourselves, with our families, and particularly with women. And colonization has really devalued women, particularly First Nations women. The idea of having a status identity took a lot of power away from women, how they would often hold the land and group their family and educate their family. A lot of that was lost to them, that natural power that they had to provide gentle, nurturing kind of care and guidance to their family. It's lost under the Indian Act. It's lost under the administration of the Child Welfare Act. It's lost under the way education was delivered through the residential school. We need to bring that back. We need to bring back the importance of the women, the matriarchs, as the influencers, as the ones who hold that community together, and often the ones who have that opportunity to see into the future and make those plans for the future. So I want to, and you talk about violence, and I really want that to be understood, that violence and trauma is not our normal, but we carry it through generation to generation because many people, that's what they've grown up with, that's what they've witnessed, and that's how they think they need to be. But we need to work on that ourselves. So when we talk about reconciliation, it's not just for the outside world, it's for us as well, to reclaim a lot of the power that we had, to take charge of our own lives, and whether it's finding a way to go back to school or to refresh our art so that we can remain very independent and make a livelihood, or we can write, or whatever we need to do to reclaim that sense of being self-sufficient, we need to just do it. And I'm there often to encourage youth, because it's hard to find sometimes encouraging voices. There's so much politics in everything that we do, in our family systems, in the outside world. There's often a lot of racism, institutional racism, different kinds of voices that will discourage young people. And they need to know it's not always that way, that there are many people who just believe in them, who see them as a light for the future. And I always talk to a lot of the young people and I say, because I need you to help me. I need you to actually help carry me sometimes. And it's helped me a lot in my life to talk to young people and to have them want to come back and look after me, to help me literally carry things and to take my hand and, you know, take me up a dark path or something like that. They help me. And I believe that's very important to have that, You know, there's a sense of responsibility between generations that sometimes gets lost. So I want to see that come back and flourish again.
The idea of helping one another, I think, is so central in so much of this work. So be it the important work that you've done helping youth, helping your people, helping protect the land, to the work of reconciliation, you know, and a lot of people are talking about how can I get involved, how can I help. Again, we've talked about a lot so far, but I think one of the things that you said was how, you know, this trauma and this violence is relatively new. It's there was actually a better time here. And when you said that, I was kind of instantly taken back to Cordova Bay in some ways. And this idea of how peaceful it can be down there and how peaceful it still could be if we were able to just take that extra step to restore what is rightfully, you know, has a right to be healthy, right? Like that those clam beds had been healthy for forever, kind of, you know, up until, you know what, the last 50 years, 60 years that we've lost our ability to have that type of food-based relationship with those places.
And I think that's the difference with Indigenous law. Indigenous law is about responsibility for those gifts that you've been provided with. So most people know about salmon and cedar. Those have been our main gifts to begin as people. So that cedar we know can be split. You don't even have to often have a tool to split it. You can split it with a wedge and you can split it with water. And so that it can be turned into planks, it can build shelter, it can be kindled really quickly, it can be kindled by shaving, so it can make you warm. It can help you in very important ways. And then the gift of salmon. There's been so much salmon for generations, and it's a gift. And that's what we've been taught. We take care of the salmon, and the salmon takes care of us. And so it's a big concern for us, the impact on freshwater systems, on saltwater systems, and of course just the taking up of so much land and development and industrialization. We have not been able to keep up to it and to protect that gift of salmon that's been given to us. So we want to try to begin to try to reconcile that and be responsible the way we were intended to be.
In some of our previous conversations, we've talked about responsibilities and responsibilities to youth and to the current generation right now. And I know that's an area that you've done a lot of work in. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about our responsibilities to youth of today.
I believe it starts even younger. We have that responsibility to children. And I know in working in education, I know how hard it's been for a lot of parents to actually assert that sense that the love that they have for their children. They're often not able to put it into work for them because they still have that historical sense of being oppressed and not being good enough, that they're not the one to influence their child. So right at the beginning, sometimes it you do need to support and help educate young parents to let them know that they have a place. And that is a hard thing to do, particularly if there's issues of addictions or mental health or poor housing, if families are having situations that are knocking them down day after day after day. Maybe they can't afford groceries. Maybe they just don't have the self-esteem that they need or a way of expressing themselves or, you know, somebody to really walk with them. It's often hard for them to believe that they have a role in influencing their children. But I think it's really important that we try to reclaim that, the nurturing of children, valuing of children, so that that pervasive anxiety that comes around with separation and disconnection and loss, that we start to ease that somewhat, that there's a bit more security that comes with raising your family and building your community.
And so much about what we heard during our work at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was that, you know, that the really hard work of learning how to love, and for some it wasn't even how to love again, it was just how to love, period, because they themselves hadn't ever had the opportunity to even feel that love. And you know, when we're talking, I think about just that relationship between responsibility and love for the land and love for children, love for ourselves, love for each other. It is a very powerful force in many ways. It's I don't know what your thoughts are, but it seems love and truth may serve us in very good stead as we do this this important work of untangling ourselves from some of this mess, eh?
Yeah, I think it's very, very hard because so many things were out of control as disease came into Indigenous communities, as the unsettlement of our communities came, people moving because influenza's here, or smallpox is here, even later polio and other diseases, measles. It's really hard to sort of sort yourself, keep your feet on the ground. And, you know, as we witness what's going on with the pandemic, you realize that it's a very hard thing to kind of get people to calm down and put into practice what they know. How can you keep yourself safe? And I think for many, in many cases, there's been a lot of fear, a lot of loss of control in Indigenous First Nations communities. And I know I even felt it as myself, having my first child and having a public health nurse come to my home to watch me bathe my baby. I had bathed dozens of babies and newborns. All through my growing up years, I was babysitter for a lot of children. I had bathed them. But when it came time for me as a 30-year-old mother to bathe my own child, I was sweating because I realized she's looking at my house, she's looking at everything, and if I don't do this, she could say I'm not fit. And even I had worked in child welfare. I was very concerned that somebody could say I'm not fit and could take my child. I knew that my family would stand behind me, my sisters in particular would get behind me, and they would say, you're not going to take that child. But it's a fear. It's a real fear for many people. And it still happens to many Indigenous First Nations at the hospital. So we need to do a lot better than what we're doing. And we need to open our hearts and our minds to each other and understand sometimes that people not talking to you, people not giving you answers may sometimes be about fear and anxiety. Mm-hmm. And you just don't know, you know, what to say. You're afraid to say. You don't trust to say. So I do think that there's a lot of work on this idea of reconciliation, and I don't, and it's not a day, it's not an event, it's a really important process where we get to learn and know each other in important ways.
And in so doing, then, as we do this learning and sharing with one another, I mean, we try to combat a lot of that judgment or that racism that's present. I can just imagine, I mean, we know so well now that the history of child welfare workers used all sorts of means to take babies away from Indigenous mothers, and so often it was based not on the fitness of the mother, so to speak, but around highly racialized views or prejudices or biases or even situations that were entirely outside of the control of mothers. And if I recall from some of our earlier conversations, I mean, that was really important work that you did to stand for mothers. And do you have any stories that you want to share with us about that?
It is really, really hard, I think, for people to make the stand and say the words that they need to say in terms of their right to raise their children or their grandchildren. It is really, really hard to do that. There's so many things that are emotional. And for many of our women, the idea of even having your own home on reserve, if you're not from that reserve, has a big implication. So that there's all kinds of, like I say, politics and oppression going on. And sometimes it's Indigenous First Nations that are doing that. When a woman stands up against violence in her home and all of a sudden she's told, well, you're not from here, you can go back home. Even if she's lived there 30 or 40 years and she's raising children and grandchildren, to be treated that way and told, you're not from here. And then at times as well, to not be well supported locally, I think, and not having people that you can rely on to advocate for you or to be your reference. I think sometimes those things are very basic. Like, how do you get to that place where everybody takes your word that you know what you're doing and that you're going to have a good shelter for your children and you're going to be able to provide food for them and medicine? Because sometimes we cannot provide medicine for our children because it's tied up in your status identity, and some children cannot get their status identity. So all of a sudden the system says, why can't you? And it's all administrative bureaucracy sometimes, so that a life-saving medication might not be able to be provided. So is that mother really unfit? Or is she just unable to navigate the bureaucracy that's been put before her? And it's a very hard thing. And we need to have more compassion. We need to have more understanding of some of those bureaucratic nightmares that still exist. And people need to understand Jordan's principle. What's that case all about? That's about a child that could not get out of the hospital because the hospital had deemed that the family, the community, was not fit. And so he was going to be permanently in care in that hospital. And we know for ourselves that even up until probably about the 70s, if a child had Down syndrome, if a child had, an Indigenous child had cerebral palsy, if they had some kind of brain injury, they often were not leaving the hospital to go back to their family. They were going to go into a special needs foster home. And there was no choice in that. And that's the issue of not being a party, a legal party to the proceedings. Your rights are taken away. You don't even have a chance to say. So there's a lot of things that need to be changed. And I think sometimes still there is that institutional racism where the system has policy and practice that reinforces that their right and Indigenous First Nations aren't right and they are somewhat inferior. And so I think it's really important that we really start to look at that, how pervasive institutional racism is in a system that's been a culture of public service that has grown in health and in Indian affairs, in managing Indian people. It's quite an industry. And so sometimes when you come up against industry, it is hard to change that.
You know, I shudder to even mention the words, because what we're talking about is just the long history of attack on the bodies of Indigenous women, and through law and through legislation and through interventions. But I can't help right now but even thinking about the stories that we heard and the evidence of the forced sterilization and state-sponsored eugenics programs as well as being a part of this entire truth that we're talking about around removing futures, removing rights, removing just the right to be a mother.
Yeah. I think it really speaks volumes to the government of the day believing that Indigenous First Nations did not have or deserve a future, and the efforts were to either assimilate or allow people to just die. And it's a lot of folks still don't accept, too, that the Navy played a part in it, in shelling the beaches where Indigenous First Nations villages were, and also the RCMP in the apprehending of children and in arresting parents and grandparents who hid children, played a role in that. And many of those folks that were put into jail for that wallowed in jail for a long time. They were not there to provide for their families. And many people don't know about those kinds of nightmares, and they don't know how could you ever get out of jail if you can't hire a lawyer. That's very fundamental to everyone. And so many of those folks did stay in jail for a long, long time. And I think that's really hard when you take away the children. It's devastating. You really lose your sense of future. You lose your sense of value. You lose your sense of purpose. And then when you're put in jail as the one who's supposed to be the provider, it becomes very hard on you as well. So I think the identity, whether the masculine or the feminine identity of individuals, gets really harmed by all kinds of abuse. And so we need to bring back, you know, that healthy sense of self that people need, so that, again, they feel that they can take care of themselves. They have a future. They could plan an education. They could plan a career. They could plan a destiny. And that, I think, is really important to do. Particularly, like I said, we see so many young children now, and we want to be able to tell them, you know, that they have a rich future. They have a chance to be out there. And similarly, that our elders have a right to safety and health and comfort in their own communities. And right now, sometimes it's the elders who basically get stuck in housing that's not appropriate, that's not safe, that might be moldy. And they're often dealing with social problems, unresolved social problems in their family that puts them in vulnerability. So I do hope, you know, that we can get to a really strong place of reconciliation for ourselves, and the truths that we begin to realize for ourselves. And then we also now begin to challenge and articulate to systems that we operate with, in partnership with, so that if we're, like I said, if we're dealing with freshwater, saltwater issues, that we can influence local governments, the provincial government, the federal government. Let's make it right. Let's really talk about truth, justice, and a way of life for people. And I really hope that there's some solution for the land, because we do need to have a sense of belonging and restoration of your place, because that's where your history is. And how can we can't even speak our history a lot of times, because there's no anchor for it. So we have our language scholars working so hard to restore language. The language grows out of the land. It grows out of the history. It grows out of the salt water. So we need to be able to anchor that so that it's not something that people think was only in the past, that it actually has a future as well.
And for you, you've got an exciting future that you're embarking on here with studies here at the University of Victoria, and you're working on your PhD.
I really have always enjoyed challenging education, going to school. And my dad told me when I was very scared and I was six and I was going to have to walk up the road to the public school, you're going to have to learn to get along. So you may as well start now. And put me out the door. And I was supposed to walk with my brothers. And then they turned around and they said, "You can't be stupid. The road to the school is one road. Follow that road. Don't stop till you get to the school." So I just kind of remember those messages, learning how to get along and don't be stupid. And so trying to tune in to what was going on, trying to be able to find my own way without panicking, you know, was kind of instilled in me really early. And I also had a strong sense of responsibility. My dad told me that to help my mother. You're your mom's helper. So I did that. And I learned how to make a fire. I was 5 years old and I could make a fire without paper, with just shavings. And I could kindle a fire. And so I learned things that made me feel very much an important part of a family. And so when I started that learning quest, like why is it a struggle? Those questions were always there for me. Like, why is it hard for some folks to do this? And it was not just Indigenous First Nations. It was many of the agricultural community that were also struggling with literacy. And I was involved with literacy, learning how to read. And then I became involved as an adult with Literacy BC and seeing many of the institutionalized men in jail that did not have basic literacy. And I'm saying, you know, we're not doing right by people, because apparently education is a right. And it's important that people are provided with a free education. So I was going, well, how come these young men in particular don't have an education? And same with children that were apprehended in the child welfare system. They did not have their education. And nobody was looking out for that. So I guess in that kind of quest, in that sense of how I was raised, I kept asking questions. I wanted to interface with systems. I was stimulated by academics. I was stimulated by the learners that I encountered, the other learners. And I was also resistant, I think, to the voices that tried to put me down or that tried to assimilate me to just be like them. And because I had to be like me, I had to be like my family, I had to be like what my dad told me or what my mom told me. And so I couldn't be like somebody else. So in very simple and basic ways, I took those messages to the institutions of learning. And I came to UVic particularly because I couldn't go far away. I've never really gone far from home. And to me, it was important to come to this institution and begin to get it to recognize me and help me. And so I did a master's work here. I did a bachelor's work here. I was a teacher by trade. I did a master's work here in Indigenous governance. In 2018, I graduated there. And then I came back to do a doctorate, and that's really to put something into the future for young people. They can look at my work and they could say, oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about, or maybe I did know what I was talking about. But they could say, this is one of our people that did this. This is a Coast Salish woman, or this is a Sayout woman, or this is a Wasanich woman. However they want to identify with me, that's fine. And one of the stories that I want to share about working, because I needed to have an education so that I could compete in work. And when I went to work for the government of British Columbia, and I was appointed the deputy superintendent of child welfare, Aboriginal child welfare, I went into a ministry office in downtown Vancouver, and a young woman came up to me and told me she had the article from the newspaper of my appointment, and she showed it to me. It was behind her desk. And she said, I never told anyone that I was First Nations until you were appointed the deputy superintendent. I had always told everyone that I was Spanish. And she said, but now I tell people that I am First Nations. And she said, I'm trying to find more about who I am and where I come from. And I was just really, really, really forever touched by that, to know how enduring it is that people need to have that sense of place and where they belong, and then needing to have a role model or somebody that they can attach their quest to was very important. So I guess that's why I think when I finished that master's work, it's like I still had lots to say. I still had lots of books. I still had lots of stories that I wanted to share, not only about my encounters with just growing up, but my encounters with career, my encounters with interfacing with social policy, my work with law, trying to influence law and how it applied to Indigenous First Nations. So I don't know when I'll be finished, but I hope to finish the doctorate work in about a year and a half, and then I'm not sure where I'll go from there.
Mm-hmm. One of our guests that we interviewed on for this podcast talked about the archaeological record and the record that is in the land as being the gifts that were left behind by those that walked before us to help us understand them better. And I think, you know, so much of this conversation that we've been talking about, be it James Island or the beaches or Sayout or even the idea of writing a thesis, a dissertation, and leaving it behind so that future generations can know what was happening in this time that we're living in, is such an, I think it's a beautiful and it's a powerful way of seeing our work too, because it's, all of this is going to take time, I suppose, and we have to be continuously thinking about those that are still coming and what they will need in order to deal with the challenges that they're going to be facing.
Yep, and I do believe that's what's really important, is that we have teachings about caring and sharing and helping. And if you live that out, the gifts do come back to you in so many different ways. Like I said, if a young person comes up to me and grabs one of my shopping bags to help carry it, it's coming back to me in that way. Somebody knocking on my door to ask if I'm okay because the weather's gone crazy and there's water running over, that's really important. You know, somebody that just looks out for you or walks beside you. You know, you think you're alone, but somebody's walks right in beside you. Those things are very important. And I think that what I've been told, if you learn something, it's not yours to hold on to. You pass it on and it comes back. And that's what I believe the work, the academic work is. It doesn't come from just me. It comes from a lot of places, and I need to give it back. And then it does come back. Whether, like I said, it comes back in criticism or it comes back in somebody else rebounding their work off of my work. That would be incredible.
Hmm. Well, we've covered quite a bit of ground, Mavis. I know we could talk forever, literally. I certainly could listen to you forever. is there anything else you wanna say? And please feel free to whatever you wish. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much that is good. You know, like a lot of people ask, you know, why aren't you more angry? Why aren't you out there demonstrating? Why aren't you, you know? But I really find I need to put my positive energy into positive things. And sometimes some of those efforts end up interfering with some of the safety that I'm trying to influence. It starts, you know, kind of negative criticism, and it may not always influence the kind of change that you want. So I do try to put my energy into positive ways. But I do also stand behind many of the demonstrations, and I believe that they're very important. I believe that our people do need to stand together and stand up for the environment that's provided for us, but also really stand up against the exploitation, the violence that's being there, industrial violence in the environment. Putting mine tailings in a fish-bearing lake that provides food is criminal, and we need to stop doing that. And we need to tell industry to stop doing that. We need to ask industry not to be in charge of logging roads that isolate and jeopardize the health and safety of Indigenous First Nations communities when that may be the only road that's been given privilege by the government. I think those are also criminal acts to be negligent that way. So I want those kinds of things that don't make sense. Change. Change now. Don't wait to be shamed through an election process or some kind of investigation or royal commission. Do it now. And I really want to have government deal with the issues of water. Indigenous First Nations communities need fresh, clean water to raise children. And the cost of water that the federal government has paid for, bottled water, they send in bottled water, and of course many people can't afford it, it's not a rational way to think. Let's start thinking rationally, put those minds together in a good way so that you have a cost-effective way to bring in fresh, clean water. And I really think that's important, particularly when many of those Indigenous First Nations communities not only rely on water for drinking and bathing, it's their food security. It holds their salmon. It holds a lot of other life systems that they need. So, like I said, let's put our minds together and do some important work that helps raise children in a healthy way. You know, so I guess that's probably all I have to say today.
Well, you've left us with a very powerful observation, I think, Mavis, that maybe not even some, but a lot of what's continuing to happen just does not make sense. You know, if we take a step back and think, what are we really doing here? Does it really make sense to pollute that clam bed? Does it really make sense to keep communities in this continual state of poverty and scarcity. Certainly our history is filled with all of these examples of things that just, especially from a human rights perspective, just really don't make sense. So I suppose the great work ahead of us, and perhaps through additional conversations on this very podcast, is going to be to help this make sense for people and to understand what the pathways out of this are. And we've talked rights, we've talked inherent rights, we've talked the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, we've talked Indigenous law, we've certainly talked a lot about resistance, your own personal resistance, the support of other people that are resisting, and fundamentally it too, I think, is also the resistance that comes through knowing who you are. One of the elders from back home, I was just talking to him this morning, he had this really great saying, I thought, and he says, never mistake our kindness for weakness.
True.
Yeah.
True. Right. It's often, I've heard people say another variation of that. I put out one hand and you grab both of them. You know, that there's many kinds of sayings like that. It's really important. I know as a woman, I have a version of that too. I may be kind, I may be polite, but that doesn't mean I want to sleep with you. Mm-hmm. You know, that proximity of being sexually exploited, being taken advantage of, was something that is always there for Indigenous First Nations women. Particularly when you work in government and you travel a lot alone, you know, you really have to be able to put up a boundary. There are a lot of assumptions. And I think in politics, the same. As an Indigenous First Nations woman, you have to be able to put up that boundary and that barrier. So, like I said, I really do hope that reconciliation, it's a task for all of us. It's something that we really need to be able to reconcile with ourselves in a very truthful way. You know, what's our role in this? And that it needs to be very active. It's not going to be written up in a report. It's not going to be written up in a policy. It's going to be in a relationship. And there may be policy around it, but how does it get led? How does it filter down from the leaders of organizations down? And that's what we're seeing now in changing employment, operating, influencing employment and how employment allows Indigenous First Nations to compete and to enter. It's really a position that leaders must take first and filter it down and show that example. Don't leave it to your HR department. Take it from the leadership down and you will start to see things change. And I really think that's where a lot of the failings have been. It hasn't been something that gets led by the leaders, by the powers that be at the top of the bureaucracy. And if we start to see more organizations embrace that kind of leadership, we will start to see positive change. And we need to have those kind of understandings about institutional racism, systemic racism, harassment. We need to see that. And we also need to really re-educate the justice system, the correction system, the judicial system, all those systems that are there, and how violence is handled in the system. Because that's one of the issues for myself, seeing in many cases, women in particular end up being homeless because they've called the police too many times and they're evicted from their apartments. That's a concern for me. Or they're told by their landlord, you can't call the police or you will be asked to leave. So they have to put up with a level of violence, spousal violence. And that's very hard for me, particularly when we know what can come from having a good home, a good place to live in.
And I think about my mom's own words here right now. I think about, you know, what she's tried to teach me, at least, about, you know, the precariousness of women's existence in regards to that profound risk of homelessness. And, you know, in her own words, she says, you know, it's hard to be homeless, but it's really super scary and dangerous to be homeless and be a woman. Things go really bad in that scenario. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, these are things that we need to know and recognize in society and need to put the fundamental steps in place to ensure that this isn't happening.
Yeah.
Okay, Mavis, well, let's leave it here for now.
Yep.
If that's okay.
Oh, yeah.
And let's leave it with a continuous and always open welcome back into this conversation. So whenever you feel like you need a microphone to talk to people through, you've always got one waiting here for you.
Perfect. Well, I want to have a little bit of a rant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. We'll have a special section called Mavis's Rants. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Awesome.
Yeah, thank you. Great.
Good. Good.